thanks for everybody to come here. And yeah, this is partly supported by the Hildred Burt Fellowship of the APS. Hildred Burt's quite an interesting character. She's actually Canadian. She was born in Southern Ontario, one of the pioneers of particle physics. So an interesting person to look up. Anyway, the outline of this talk is, it's not on the back. The introduction and motivation, why? And then I'm going to start with a simple geometrical trick, and it is a very simple trick. I'm still not clear on exactly how generally applicable it is. There certainly are some restrictions, and I haven't identified all of them. I can tell you what some of them are. And this gives you a fresh set of error correction codes. It allows you to take a higher dimensional error correction code and convert it into something that lives in 2D or 3D. And then I'm going to explore the ramifications of that. I think we're all familiar with toric codes, yes? You construct your Hamiltonian such that you have these operators here. That's your, you attach a negative constant around that. And so your ground state is the plus one eigenstate of these operators. I think everybody's seen this dozens of times. There are known problems with these. One of them is that they don't work in 2D. They do, but not well enough. They don't support a universal gate set. Other codes, I think, do. And they're only thermally stable in four dimensions. And there was some interesting work done by Hastings and Roger Melko and two or three other people about 2012, maybe, 2013. And they looked at higher dimensional analogs of the toric code, and they just looked at the entanglement propagation properties as a function of temperature. And they found a percolation transition that occurred in five or six dimensions or thereabouts. And the data collapse, when their long-term behavior sets in. They saw that when they had their hypercube that they were simulating, the edge lengths got to about, I think, three, maybe four edge lengths. And then there's, of course, a notorious issue of gate errors. You can have background noise that affects your code, that's part of the memory errors. But when you do a gate, your gates are going to be imperfect, and again, going to introduce errors of their own. And you need to fix those errors, otherwise you're going to get the wrong answer. And this turns out to be hard. There's a paper by Easton and Nil, which shows that you can't do a traversal set that's also universal. So there's a kind of fallback position of locality preserving gates, so that that it doesn't spread too badly. The error syndrome, it does spread, but slow enough that you have some prospect of catching it. But there are limitations on that as well. And there was this paper. Well, there's several papers that are, they're not quite no-go theorems, but they're kind of obstacle theorems. We would have to get past these to build a working computer. The most recent one, and I think the most stringent and restrictive, is by Beveland now. There's about six authors, maybe. Rob Koenig and Sumit Seja, and I think Oliver Bershapper and Fernando Pastarsky and somebody else, might have been John Preskill. And they showed that if you look at the set of gates that are locality preserving, and you look at them as a function of anion model, you find that for ordinary non-abelian anions, you just get the Clifford group, which is classically simulatable. You have to supplement with magic states or some such in order to get something that's computationally universal. And with Fibonacci anions, which if you could find them would be great because they are computationally universal just on their own, but you just get a discrete group if you restrict to locality preserving gates, so that's kind of it's nothing, basically. You can't do these gates. The other way to do gates is by braiding, more famously for topological quantum computing. That's not a free lunch either. You have to do it adiabatically or you get more errors. You still get some errors. That's not a free lunch either. So, it seems like trying to make these things fault tolerant is going to be rather harder than everybody first thought when they wrote down, you can do everything topologically, right? That's going to isolate you from local error syndromes. Well, actually, it's not quite as simple as that. Try hitting the right button, it works better. Right, so this is the trick, and it's really, really simple. Here's your hypercubic lattice, which we're gonna think of as, well, it can be 4, 5, or 6, right? If it's just a simple cubic, it should be 5 or 6. And you have, you take a plane that you slice through that lattice, and you have to choose the right angle, right? And it needs to be that one, right? And then you have an acceptance window, which is one lattice spacing wide in the standard definition. If you want a single layer tiling, that is the correct choice to make. And you just project down. So if the atom is within the acceptance window, you keep it. And if it isn't, then you don't. So that one's just outside and gets dropped. Now this gives you an aperiodic tiling. This is the famous construction for Penrose tilings. And the other thing that's drawn here is a rational approximant, where it's actually an angle, and you can see that it hits an atom every 3 spacings. Right, so that's a periodic approximant. And you notice there's a slight angle between these. So, has everybody seen, I mean, you've probably seen this before. This is quite famous. This is the standard way of making Penrose tilings. Okay, how familiar are people with facts about quasi-periodic tilings? Right, okay. So you've at least heard of this trick, right? Okay, so here's our pretty little Penrose tilings. That's what a hypercubic graph looks like for 5-dimensional hypercube. We'll be coming back to that later. I think we've all seen this, yes? We've got these arrow matching rules, and you have these angles in here, and they're all multiples of pi by 5. And there are perhaps the most important bit of information on this slide is you have a certain set of allowed vertices. Now, every vertex in here is one of these. Right? If you see something else happening, you've got a defect. Now, those are interesting in their own right, but they're not supposed to be there in the perfect tiling. There's a nice little thing on this online if you want to have more detail. So I'm worried that I'm going to run out of time on this. In fact, I'm sure I'm going to run out of time. So what happened there? Anyway, that is not supposed to be there. That's supposed to be a little bit up. I must have got caught with a thing. This is deflation rules. You can rescale these things. And you can see there's a smaller tiling here and a bigger tiling. So if this is the original tiling, there's a set of rules that you can use to decorate your tile. And if you paint that on everything, you get a smaller tiling. So this allows you to take a very simple patch, simple motif of Penrose tilings, and perform this operation recursively. You can generate a very large tiling without defects. And that's a useful trick to have, because these matching rules are necessary for you to have a valid Penrose tiling, but they're not sufficient. Right? So you can quite happily match your matching rules and follow them, and then eventually discover that you've got a defect and you don't know where that came from. And that's because the Penrose matching rules with the arrows are not sufficient. Right? You do have to have them, but you need a little bit more than that. There's an icosahedral version as well. There's lots of chemistry papers with these very pretty structures in them. That's one icosahedral tiling. There are plenty of others, and with corresponding matching rules. I'm going to largely ignore icosahedral tilings simply because they are fiddly. So for this, I'm just going to stick to Penrose tilings. You could do this. I mean, the other point of view, if you want to build a working quantum computer, you would really like your codes to be in 2D if you can. It makes getting at the information in them and manipulating them in the whole quantum control problem much, much easier. So I'm going to largely ignore this, although it does exist. There's also this useful trick as well. In fact, you don't have to start from a 5-dimensional hypercubic lattice. You can actually project things down to the A4 root lattice. And all that is you can reduce one of the dimensions to a finite range, and you just put that in there so that the extra points wind up in the middle of the faces of the 4-dimensional hypercube. So that's a 4-dimensional hypercube there. And you get an extra set of points that sits there, and there, and there, and there, and what have you. So you can actually do the cut and project in 2 steps. You can go via the 4-dimensional hypercube, and then from that, which turns out to be quite a fortuitous coincidence. OK, Okay, now, the mutterings about conformal symmetries in the abstract. This is not actually, as far as I think, it's actually not actually known whether all of these systems are necessarily described by conformal field theories. They do satisfy the right symmetry group. So they're not translationally invariant, they're not rotationally invariant, not exactly. I mean, they look kind of rotationally invariant, but they're not. Okay, there's a kind of fivefoldness to the pattern, but it's not invariant when you rotate it. Now, Lorentz symmetry, you have to have the metric, is invariant when you do the elements of the group. And that has to be exact, right? You can't rescale it. Conformal symmetry, you allow an extra bit of wriggle room. You allow it to be some conformal multiple of the metric. And those rescaling rules are a sort of deflation rules that I just waved at you. That's when those show up. You know, you can translate and rotate, and there will be somewhere in which that tiling matches. Right? You can rescale it far enough, and you will find a match. Okay, so that's the significance of that. Now, if you look at this, this is Lorentz. This here is the spin statistics theorem that we're all familiar with. So for p greater than or equal to 3, you just get bosons and fermions. That there is your anions by the standard spin statistics argument. And that is, well, whatever that is. Looks like not a lot. In the conformal symmetry scenario, you have more room. But you've got to offset your space dimension count by 1. So this is actually 1D, this is 2D, okay? And 3D and 4D and all the way up. All the way up for all of these, you get that there, right? Which you can get, means you can get anion-like things, structures, in systems that obey a conformal symmetry. Right? There's some extra wriggle room if you abandon Lorentz symmetry and you move to a more general one. Now, of course, if you have a translationally invariant lattice, you are stuck with that, right? This is something that you specifically get by ditching the translationally invariant lattice and switching to one that's quasi-periodic.
Are you going to be talking about gap phases?
I'm not going to get that far. I mean, the symmetry structure, these energy spectrum for these systems, if you compare them, we don't have analytic results, really. So if there are analytic results for more than 1D, I haven't found them. They could be out there. There's some numerics, which are very suggestive. There's also the point that you can have physical systems that are quasi-crystals that are actually, you know, some crystal that grew. But you can also construct them. There's a lot of stuff in the photonics literature about these things. And of course, if you're constructing the system, you've got a lot more control over things like the Hamiltonian. So in a way that it is, you know, it's very difficult to make a general statement about spectrum that is always going to be true. What we do tend to see is fractal spectrum. These things have a actual quasicrystals have a tendency to have spectra that are fractal, and in particular, you get Cantor sets turning up, which is one of the things you sort of watch out for if you're doing quantum computing. So I've written the lattice. I haven't specified the code. I'm not sure what the best code for this is. I mean, what I'm going to do is look at some very, very briefly at some examples. You know, some of them have pluses, some of them have minuses, in terms of, you know, pros and cons, and I'll just give you some idea of how these things work. One of the issues you have to watch out for this is you're not guaranteed to get a Penrose tiling just because you start with 5 dimensions and you project onto a surface at the right slope. But you need more than that. You need the group describing your lattice. It needs to contain a decagonal cyclic group as a subgroup so that when you rotate it, the plane in which you are aiming for, the plane itself, is left invariant. If things waggle around, then you are not going to get a nice Penrose tiling. So for example, if you think nice codes for topological systems, a lot of the things you would immediately think of, like the color code and generalized color codes, hi Courtney, you know, there's a whole bunch of models and they all live on hexagonal lattices. Now, I don't actually know whether you can generate a Penrose tiling starting from a hexagonal lattice. That would be a really good question, though, you know, to look at. So I'm going to restrict to cubic lattices for today, simply because they work. Right? You should not take that as being definitive. So don't take these examples too seriously. It is entirely possible that none of them are particularly good. If you can make this work on a higher dimensional analog of a hexagonal lattice, so you get some kind of color code, you know, given how good color codes are, that would be a natural candidate. So, I mean, the obvious one is a 4D toric code that actually has a proven thermal stability proof. It actually has one. Now, this one is kind of a near miss. The Z-plaquettes are cubes with the qubit on the face, not on the corners, not on the edges, but in the middle of the face. And the star operators are, so some chalk would be good at this point, I think. Like that. And the fourth dimension one, I'm going to draw like that. I'm going to do a different color because it's a really nasty projection. It's like that. So if you were not terribly au fait with how color with how toric codes work, and you just wrote down the obvious thing for a star operator in a three-dimensional toric code, which that's the obvious thing, and it doesn't work because you have an odd number of overlapping points. But instead of doing that, you have a second one and join these up in four-dimensional space, which I'm completely failing to draw, right? So is it clear on what these are? And the qubits on this code defined to live on the faces. So it's one way of generalizing a toric code. I mean, the defining characteristics of toric codes is they are CSS codes, so your check operators are either all Zs or all Xs. And they are designed in such a way that they only overlap on an even number of qubits, so they mutually commute, which means the model can be exactly diagonalized. Now, that is a thing about toric codes. You can relax that, so you have non-commuting check operators and restricted lattices. And in fact, you end up wanting to do that because some of the no-go theorems that I didn't list explicitly apply to codes which have commuting check operators, and they don't necessarily apply to ones that have non-commuting check operators. Right, so, I mean, this is a way of constructing a simple-minded code, right? It shouldn't be taken as, like, graven in stone as this is how you have to do it. So the plus side of this one is they have a wonderfully low generator weight, right? I mean, it's very easy to write down stuff that has incredibly large footprints, right? And you look at that and say, well, you know, realistic Hamiltonians generally a two-body Hamiltonians, and you've written down something with, I mean, six is a lot. One of the naive things you might write down has one set of generators that have 32 spins in them, which is getting way beyond silly. And as I said, it's kind of one of the nice features of color codes is that they have much lower weights. I mean, they have like two qubit generators. So that's one feature of this thing. But the downside of this is it doesn't occupy the corners in the A4 lattice, right? You're missing things here, right? So your projection trick may not work. I mean, you can have it do the thing geometrically, but we'll see in a bit that something goes pear-shaped if you do that. So that's the first candidate. Second one is just a naive 5D toric code, which has the ridiculous weight. Okay, so that's just, you have to ensure that you have an even number of overlaps between the two different types of operators. So if you've got an odd dimension, you pick one of them to be an odd, and you then reduce the size of the other one so that it's even, that ensures you have an even overlap. I mean, you might lose some of that weight when you do the projection step, but that's also one of those things that's not quite as simple as you might think from the simple way that I've set it out so far. There was a surprise in the experimental data, which I think, you know, maybe possibly why these haven't been looked at before. So, and then there's this thing, which I literally made up over breakfast this morning, so I don't know any results about it, just how to write it down. So these ones, you have Z plaquettes are 3 cubes. You want to keep your Z plaquettes small if you can, because they blow up faster in terms of their weight. Nathan? No?
Oh,
right. Your X stars are like the one from the Dennis and Dennis and Co code, but I'm going to add one extra spin at the center, but not on the edges where you'd normally find them in a toric code, and not on the end points. So nowhere on the edges, not on the corners, not on the ends of the intersection lines. But your Z plaquettes are 3 cubes, and they have spin on each face and a spin on the corners. Now you can tile your A4 lattice with those, and it's set up so that you have even overlaps with 4 spins, right? So you have a Z plaquette hitting an X star. You have 3 qubits from the faces interacting with the X star, plus the one on the corner. So you pick up the central one for the X star, and that picks up one of the corners on the Z plaquette, but not the others, because I carefully specified that I don't have stuff on the edges of the 3 squares that I made up my Z plaquette with.
So you're
X star.
You're breaking a rotational symmetry there. Is that right?
No. This is
one of the corners that you're using for the X star.
No, it's the central one.
I see this. Oh, you're centered around the corner.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, what you have with these things is, where's I put my white chalk? There. So what I would do is, can everybody see this? This is kind of really dingy. I'm going to draw this badly in sort of 3D. And then, it's a dreadful drawing. Right, can somebody make up some idea what I'm trying to do with that? So I have one set of 4 squares like that, one set of 4 squares like that, and then one set like that, so that they cross each other in a kind of central star arrangement. Now, I think the four-dimensional analog of that, so there's another one that lives in 4 dimensions. And then you put your qubits in the middle of the faces, and then one in the middle. Right? Don't put anything along the outer edges. Right? So nothing there, nothing there, nothing there. You have one in the middle, and then on each of the middle of the faces, you have a qubit. Right? And that will be an X, a Pauli X on there. Yeah? So when this thing hits a cube, if I switch colors, that will be better. I see, can we see this as a different color? So here's my cube that I've had abutting with this. And so that will hit there, one at the back, one there, and then one in the middle. And this is a 3 cube, not a 4 cube. Right, so this thing stays in 3 dimensions. This thing is, whereas, so the Z, is a 3D object, but the X operator is a 4-dimensional object, right? So when they intersect, they will hit on 4 spins, yeah? So actually, that's not quite correct notation. But anyway, the Z plaquettes are 3-dimensional objects, and the X stars are 4-dimensional objects, right?
Do you know what the degeneracy of this code is?
I have no idea. I wrote it down over breakfast this morning.
Okay.
I was looking for something that would sit on that lattice nicely. And whilst obeying the general rules for toric codes and sort of more in the spirit than the letter of them, in that, you know, it should be a CSS code and things should only collide on an even number of spins. Right, so I put in those 2 constraints and I want to sit on the A4 lattice and preferably keep the weight down. Right, I mean, it's not as good as the Dennis code. We will maybe lose some of that when we do the cut and project. And in particular, we expect to lose commutativity when you do that. That's another thing that happens with a cut and project. And of course, I have no idea of the thresholds of this because I wrote this down this morning. So logic operators. For four-dimensional codes of this type, your logic operators are always non-trivial surfaces. So if you have something that's a closed surface and you can smoothly contract it back down to a point, that's trivial, that's an stabilizer. If it's, you think of this thing as a high-dimensional torus, it's got to wrap around the torus. Or if you've unwrapped the code so it has boundaries, then there's various rules for having things hit boundaries and what have you, and you have to follow those rules. Anyway, what you're thinking about is two-dimensional surfaces running around in a four-dimensional space. And in four dimensions, you can have two surfaces can intersect at one point only. Right? Which you can't do in 3D. 3D, you have two surfaces, they intersect in a line. Right? 4D, you can do it in a point. And that geometrically is the reason why these codes start working in 4D. Right? You know, there's a reason for that. It's kind of a kind of error correction code version of Pyle's argument. It's kind of inspired by that. So this maybe should have been animated, but just as well, it wasn't given the problems. I take my surfaces, and they can be any non-trivial surface, right? They don't actually have to be flat. They don't have to do, well, anything, right? They're just non-trivial surfaces, and they have to be independent so that they form a basis, because you want to have, you've got your encoded space that sits in your encoded code space that has a certain dimension, and you can manipulate objects in that by using your logic operators, and you know there's a basis in that, and you can move things around and what have you. So, I mean, your logic operators with toric codes, they're highly degenerate codes. So really, they're an equivalence class up to stabilizer elements. So you can choose what these are, and it makes sense to have something with a nice low footprint, because if you're worried about fault tolerance, the undesirable logic operation that's most likely to happen is the one with a small footprint. I mean, the difference between an uncorrectable error and a logic operation is whether or not you want it to happen, right? So if you're worried about fault tolerance, you need to look at the ones with a small footprint because those are the ones you have to worry about. If you're thinking about it in terms of doing the gates, those are the ones that are easier to do. So you can choose your basis to minimize the footprint of your logic operators, and you will notice that you can, some of them, there's an irreducible number which are stripes, because that's just where the plane cuts the cut and project, the plane that we projected onto. So some of them will be lines, but you can also choose bases so that some of them are reduced all the way down to blobs, right? Those are the intersecting at a point thing that can happen with two planes in a four-dimensional space. Can anybody see why that's true?
Sorry, so
I need to stop drawing stuff. Let's
well,
get rid of
it. If you could go on 4D, that would help, probably. But
yeah, well, I can't, but I can do the usual 2D heuristic that you see in these things. Okay, so here's my original grid. If I'd gotten here earlier, I could have done these on the blackboard and hidden them. So I could do them in advance without spoilerizing my own talk. Need a little bit more. So here's my cut and project step. And I hopefully haven't hit a periodic approximant by accident. There is actually physics in these things being bendy, but I'll come back to that later if I get time. So here's your plane, right, because you collapse these down onto your target plane. Right, so there's your plane. And your logic operators live out here in your space. Right, these are your moving planes that you're doing your operators with, say. Now, here, you've got this thing, which is intersecting with my intersection window. And so this is going to show up as a stripe, right? Because this is coming out of the plane. Okay. Now, I can choose my basis so that I have one logic operator which comes dead down, and that one may be string-like, which is actually bad news. Just thinking about this now. String-like, there's a result by Yongwan Ha showing that string-like logic operators are generally trouble from the point of view of thermal stability. So you would like things that look like stripes. But if you think about it a bit more, you can realize when you do this cut and project step, there will be, right, if I now look at the plane onto which I am projecting from above, right, precisely because you can have a plane intersect with another plane at a point, there will be planes that only intersect this at a point. Right, so they were planes in the higher dimensional space, they were logic operators in the higher dimensional space, but they are completely orthogonal to your target plane. Now those will look like this. They'll be localized blob-like patches, which means they're not very fault-tolerant, are they? They're kind of localized, the sort of things that can happen with thermal noise. I mean, you know, you'll get a certain amount of a patch, right? But it's still way too local. So those are going to wind up being gauge qubits, right? And those are the extra things, extra qubits that you have in the encoded space, which are not logic qubits, because they can, they end up with various noise syndromes winding up, ending up in them. They're not quite gauge, as in local gauge symmetry, but the name is inspired from that. So these things here, those end up as the logic operators that are hit by logic operator, the qubits in the encoded space, which are hit by logic operators that look like that, are your gauge qubits.
So sorry, the stripe-like ones are finite width?
Yeah, they will be, well, you can choose one of them to be string-like, right? So that will be, look just like the ones you get in a regular toric code, right? You know how it is in the regular toric code, right? You want it, your encoded X is that, going all the way around. Remember that? Okay. So one of them will look like that because I've chosen the basis so that it. But actually, that may not be a. For the error syndromes, you need to worry about that one. You can choose at most one of them to be like that.
But then the other ones are.
They're going to have to be at an angle.
And so they have some finite width. Or is it finite width, or is it some width that scales with the system size?
It should be finite.
Okay.
Because it's governed by this acceptance window width. So I mean, when you choose your error base, your logic operator basis, you're rotating that basis in the four-dimensional space, and you are choosing it so that, you know, to minimize the amount of footprint.
So in one direction, it wraps all the way around the torus?
Yeah, if you think, I mean, I'm kind of implicitly assuming these things are defined on a torus. So it'll be the same basic rules as you get for a 4D toric code. The only difference is that I've gone and done this cut and project step on top of that. Okay? I mean, this is a very simple-minded example. I will be astonished if that turns out to be the optimal way of doing it. Right? this is about the geometrical trick, right, rather than the details of the code, because I haven't got anywhere near optimizing that code. So.
In the higher D code, you have gates involving nearest neighbors in the higher D space,
yes.
But you only keep those gates in the lower D code if they connect two vertices that are both in the acceptance stripe right there. Is that the idea?
Well, I mean, you will. If you think of this as, how do I explain this? I mean, yeah, this is a finite width slab, right? Before you do the project, when you do the cut step, you're actually slicing out a finite width slab in the higher dimensional space, right? So if you've got logic operators running around in that are planes, they're going to hit it, right? The only question is by how much.
And the stabilizer generators. You keep ones that are only completely within the path, or you keep all of them and then just throw away any qubits that are outside the.
You throw away the qubits that are outside, so
okay.
you cut them down.
But some of them then become gauge operators. No,
well,
sorry, it's logic ones that become gauge operators.
Maybe I haven't taken this that far yet, but I mean one thing you will get is you have. You can have a code that's fully commutative in the higher dimensional higher dimensional space that you started off with. And once you've cut it down, and I mean, so, right, here is, say this was a star operator, right? These two are inside, those two are out, they get dropped. So what gets left is that. Yeah? Okay, so you just chop it off. So like sawn off stabilizer generators. All right, so here is my line of operators that I had. It's a line on this heuristic. It would be a plane in the original four-dimensional space. And this cuts that slab in a certain region. And so, you know, this one is inside, this one is inside, that one's just outside. So this stripe would contain that. And as I sweep the plane through, right, it will pick things up in a stripe. I mean, this is patch light because I've thrown away two dimensions. Right, if I do it in the original four-dimensional space, projected down into two dimensions, I get a line.
So maybe you're going to say this, but so this is not commuting now, as you said.
It won't be commuting now because you've sawn bits off your generators.
And so how are you defining the code as via the Hamiltonian or something?
Well, I mean, it's the surviving bits of stabilizer operators.
Yeah, but normally a stabilizer has to commute, so it's not a stabilizer.
Okay, so it's not a stabilizer, it's whatever you call them when they don't commute.
Well, what's the subspace of the Hilbert space that you're keeping?
It's whatever your ground state is going to, it doesn't actually have to be your ground state.
I see, so it's just by the Hamiltonian. So
it's defined by the, here is my Hamiltonian. I can't solve it because it's non-commutative.
Right, okay.
Right, but it has some kind of ground state with a certain amount of degeneracy to it,
right,
because
okay.
That's where I'm going to park my information.
Yeah, okay, that was my question.
And also, because it's a subsystem code, it may even end up that the place where you want to put your information doesn't actually have to be the ground state. This is a thing about noiseless subsystem codes that is kind of obscure because it's never turned up in a real system. But okay, so has everybody got a rough idea what this is? I mean, don't get too hung up on this... On the A4 code, because it's just something I pulled out of my ear this morning. But I mean, can you see how the geometry works? That you're going to get some logic operators, because they have to be independent, right? You can't mash them all down to being localized patches, because then you wouldn't have a spanning set anymore. So they've got to form some kind of basis in terms of your logic operators on your code space.
But the logical operators will have to commute with, well, I guess, they don't have to, but you normally want them to commute with what's left of the stabilizer generator.
Mm.
Is that automatic, or?
Well, I mean, you can have noiseless subsystem codes where you actually get conjugation. You just have to know how to compensate for that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, things get fiddly once you start introducing gauge qubits.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are already highly not soluble, or at least I don't know how to solve them. So you might end up having to try and tackle it numerically. But anyway, I mean, the point is that there's no free lunch when you do this cut and project. You do retain some of the topological properties, and actually if you look through the literature on quasicrystals, there is a lot of stuff about the higher dimensional topology. The topological properties are largely conserved when you do this cut and project. And so you can have a two-dimensional system, which in terms of its topological properties, it behaves like the higher dimensional system. And there's experimental evidence to corroborate that. So, you know, this really does retain a lot of the topology, just not all of it, right? And what you pay for it is, I mean, A, your life is harder because you can't solve the thing by writing down the answer. And also you lose some of your carrying capacity of your code because you can't put data into gauge qubits. So, you know, it's not a free lunch, but, you know, it does allow you to circumvent the existing, obstruction theorems. Because, I mean, these things they're not translationally invariant. They are subsystem codes, which you would expect to see if it was going to actually do something useful about. Because, I mean, the earlier ones are the no-go theorems. They were for translationally invariant systems, and... for commuting stabilizers, right? If you have non-commuting check operators, then there was a loophole, and that loophole's been known about for years. But, okay. That PDF stat was not harmless, right? That there is supposed to be over there. Hopefully the next one will, you'll see what it was supposed to be doing. Okay, so what I did was I got hold of some real data and a hypercube graph, and I was initially looking for 5 cubes, but you can actually see where the 4 cube is embedded in that. That's a hypercube there, 4-dimensional hypercube. And look at the actual data and play hunt the piquet. Because if you can just see an almost complete one there, that is a decagonal patch. And you can actually come up with matching rules that will generate Penrose tilings that are perfect tilings by defining it in terms of these patches. Right, there are overlap rules, so that's a legal overlap there. And I can't see one that's the bigger overlap. You can see this one is just overlapping there with one that's starting up there. But yeah, unfortunately that slid off because I had a nice Penrose tiling there and I could show you how all the bits worked. And unfortunately it got chewed up when we did the export. But anyway, this is real data. This is from this stuff. This is a paper from 1992. And this is the Penrose tile. This is the smallest Penrose tile that the guy could fit on the data. So that's the thin rhombus and that's the fat rhombus. I'm really happy about what I was trying to do, even if things went walkies. Right? So yeah, get hold of the actual experimental data and go looking for Plaquette operators. And I noticed something rather surprising. You've got a little one of these hypercubes which I've rescaled, and I've parked it on that lattice. And you'll notice that every single one of the dots, if, I don't know if you can see, anyone who's red deficient colorblind isn't going to be able to see this at all, but every single one of those dots lines up, you see, because that's it without, and that's it with the hypercube on, and they're all present. And that shouldn't happen because we cut it down. And here's another one. They're all present. And what this other one that I put here is, you see, this is the edge length for the Penrose tiling. And you'll see it's roughly 2/3. Right, I mean, I think this got squished when I was moving it around in PowerPoint, but on the original paper, I measured it, and up to measurement error, this is like 2/3. I've got intact hypercubes, and I shouldn't be seeing them, so what's going on? And I realized at this point about the acceptance window is what's going on with that. If you want to generate a tiling, which is a nice single layer tiling, you want your acceptance window to be one lattice spacing wide. Right, so if you're working on tilings, which is what Penrose was doing when he originally came up with this thing, that's the correct choice to make. Right? But there's no absolute rule that says that that has to be one lattice spacing wide. Right? I can choose to change that. I can make it 3 lattice spacings wide if I want to. Right? And that would give this. Right? This is what you would see. You would see the intact type, because if I make this 3 spacings wide, if I triple the width, which is about there, right, I'm going to see a whole bunch of intact hypercubes, yes? Right, and I'm going to see them on that length scale, and I'm going to see them on that length scale. Right, so if I'm seeing intact hypercubes at like 1/3 and 2/3 of the edge length, then I've got an acceptance window for that that's 3 lattice spacings wide. Now, of course, we don't know what the Hamiltonian is on this model. This is something in the lab. Its Hamiltonian could be quite different. Right? And we don't even know what the code is. So the question of what is a Hamiltonian is distinctly vague. The interaction topology on this could be quite different. And Birkhoff has sketched in some kind of nearest neighbor thing which looks quite different from a hypercube. So, you know, just because it looks like a hypercube doesn't mean that there's actual real life plaquettes happening there. Right, just for some reason, the system has decided to adopt that form. And while that might be an optimal packing of the atoms into the space, it doesn't really look like it to me, especially since quasicrystals are often subject to a lot of strain, which corresponds to this Faison strain, corresponds to the acceptance window being like not straight, okay, geometrically. And so what happens is you have atoms not be in places where they should be or be in places that they shouldn't. So it's possible that's an optimal packing, but it doesn't look terribly likely. And also you notice that the middle one seems to be missing for reasons that are unclear. It could be that it just, actually I don't know why that's missing. It's the only one that's missing. It could be that it just didn't show up on the data, I don't know. But if we go back, you can see that it's missing here as well without my putting the hypercubes on it. So there is this odd pattern in the data, and I have no idea why it's there. It is suggestive, certainly, but it's not proof. But it did raise the question of whether or not we should stick with the assumption that the acceptance window is one lattice spacing wide. Now, if you remember way back at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned this Monte Carlo results from Hastings and Melko and two or three other people. And they found that the data collapse, the long-range behavior, shows up when you have four, maybe five atoms along the side of the hypercube. So, you know, this three lattice spacings wide would be the right size for, how's the best way to say this? I mean, the quantum Monte Carlo results from five and six dimensions suggest that, you know, in terms of its entanglement, the system can only see about three, maybe four lattice spacings. Right? And after that, it really doesn't know what happens further away from that. It's kind of short range. So, I mean, if it can't actually see further away than that, then, you know, to what extent does the rest of the lattice even need to be there? And if you have, you know, an acceptance window that is wide enough that it's of that scale, that will be further evidence that this system might actually mimic the higher dimensional behavior rather more closely than you might have expected to see with a single lattice spacing. Because a single lattice spacing acceptance window, that costs you a lot of structure in the operators. There's a huge amount that gets sawn off. All right, there are no completely intact stabilizer operators if you have a single lattice spacing on your cut and project. Everything loses at least one qubit, often quite a lot more than that. Right, so it's a very drastic thing to use an acceptance window that's only one lattice spacing wide. Whereas if you make it three lattice spacings wide, you're going to get some completely intact stabilizer operators. So you'll have the kind of core, which is fully commuting and is nice and strongly protected, and you have some loss of commutativity from the stuff off the edges, near the edge of the acceptance window, which is going to get bits sawn off it because of the projection. Okay. Right, so at this point I'm going to switch to doing drawing stuff on the board, because trying to explain this to a computer is just too frustrating. So first thing I'm going to do is going to wheel out a tiling motif, because, I mean, everybody's familiar with the way that these things are, in the first instance, are defined on toruses, right? That's why they're called toric codes. It's easier to define the thing on a torus. It makes the boundary condition simpler, right? Right, now these lattices are specifically aperiodic, right? You can't put them on a torus, right? Now, there are an awful lot of results, and in particular, the no-go theorems. Right, the opening move in the proof is take your lattice and put it on a torus. And then you make some usually fairly reasonable assumptions, and then the kind of annoying result follows. Now, these things, because they're aperiodic, you can't put them on the torus. But if we want to analyze the code, we should kind of make a good faith attempt to do that. So you can't put it on a torus perfectly, but you can try and, you know, then deal with the bits that don't fit. Now, I've tried various ways of doing it, and I believe this is the optimal one. It's to start with this tiling motif like this. Now, this is a skinny rhombus. That's what they're called. And this is a fat rhombus. Okay, so this angle here is pi by 5. That is 4 pi by 5. This is 3 pi by 5. And that's 2 pi by 5. And the arrow matching rules go like that. And like that. Right. Now, the other thing you want to notice about this is The original hypercubic lattice was bicolorable because it's cubic. And you know, we can hang on to bits of that. Well, that's far too dingy. Hang on to bits of that with this thing. So that, those are its neighbors, and then color those ones. Now this matters because this is what causes trouble for the four-dimensional code by Dennis and Co. Right? Is this coloring turns out to cause trouble? So I have this thing. This is my tiling motif, and I'm going to try and roll it up to make a torus. And I'm going to join these four together. Whoops. Okay, so this here is going to be, what we're aiming for is to try and get a torus like this. We're not going to manage it, but we can try. So this here is going to end up being the inner seam that goes around like that. Okay, so I'm going to fold this thing up like that and then try and stick the ends together. Okay, so that will end up being the inner circuit, and then you will have the rest of it will kind of go around the other cycle. Okay, now you can't actually do that with this thing because it doesn't work. And if you try, instead of getting a torus like you were originally hoping to get, right, what you get is something that looks like this. This is why I decided to switch to chalk at this point, trying to get a computer to understand what I'm trying to get it to draw at this point. It's like not fun. So it looks like a torus over here. I mean, I'm hoping it's obvious that in order to do this properly, to follow the track of the proof as closely as you can, you have to respect matching rules when you're folding it up. Because otherwise you're just going to get a jagged mess when nothing zips up. You want this thing to be, try and get something that respects the tiling rules as much of the time as you can, so almost everywhere. So you have to respect the matching rules when you're rolling this thing up. Okay, now it does respect the matching rules. And what you end up with here, so this thing here winds up there. And this other thing here, mark that like that. That winds up here, right? So I got a point there and a point there, and those are the only two points in which this goes pathological, because what you end up with at those two points is an illegal vertex. Remember I pointed out earlier about you have eight legal types of vertex. The vertex that you end up with that corresponds to these isn't one of those. And if you add up the angles on that, you will find that this has got an angle defect. So that's minus 2 by pi 5. And this has got an angle excess of 2 pi over 5. Right, and that's one of the reasons why I think this is optimal, is because the net angle defect and excess, when you add them all up, has to add up to 0, because this thing is a toroid. It has Euler characteristic 0, so everything has to add up to 0. So that means you've got to have at least 2, right? 1 plus or 1 minus.
So if you cut... If you cut a cross-section of this object through those two marked points,
right,
would you get like a lemon sort of shape or a heart shape, maybe?
Well, I mean, I've drawn it as a kind of lemon.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's kind of a saddle in there.
Right, okay.
And I've drawn it there because if you look at the sort of inside thing of a torus, it sort of looks like a saddle, only it isn't because it has no intrinsic curvature. Right, so I've just made this a little bit pointier here, which I've kind of exaggerated there. It's nowhere near that sharp.
So basically, this is still topologically a torus. It just has...
Yes, it has two conical singularities on it.
Yeah.
So any piece of machinery that requires that your torus be a smooth manifold, you can't use because you've got to maneuver around those points. Right, so I can look at what happens if I drag an anion or whatever around this, right? And this is nowhere near the problem region. Well, okay, that's not quite true. There's this dotted line that I've drawn here I need to talk about that now because that's relevant. The significance of the coloring, if you look at how I've joined these points together, it's going to break the coloring. Okay, so that means you're going to have a Dane twist happening here. So if I start hopping on, say, the light sublattice, and I go round, and I'm going to come back and I'm going to find them on the dark sublattice. Okay, so I have to go around twice to get back to where I started. So it's not, I don't think it's quite a double covering in the normal sense, but there is something like that that is reminiscent of a double covering. And in fact, there's another sort of hiccup line. I mean, you can't see this locally, right? There's no obvious line painted on it that you can say, right, there's the line. But you know that if you go around this thing, you're going to switch sublattices. Yeah?
I mean, it sounds like these twists.
Yes, it is a twist.
Yeah.
Right? And that means that these things, I mean, we know from, there's a couple of papers there, so one by Hector Bombin, and then there's another one called, I think it's topological quantum order with a twist, by, I think, Barnett or Bartlett and two or three other people. If you have conical singularities with angle defects, right, and you have those on a lattice that was bicolorable until you introduced the defects, right, that can give you very powerful gate sets. You can take something that's an abelian model, introduce defects, and get it to emulate a model which is non-abelian, so it can increase the computational power. Now, I mean, this is something that I wrote down, okay? If I define this as an abstract code that is sitting on an abstract torus, then those things are there. If I think about this as, oh, well, this is actually a flat motif tile, and I rolled it up because it makes my life easier, but it's really flat and it has edges, right? It's less clear what exactly we should think about that, because these are the corners. Right, in the original object, these are the corners. So, I mean, what does that mean when we unwrap it? So, I mean, okay, what's happened here is, I mean, the theorems that are built on first put your lattice on a torus, then all of those have just broken. So, I'm now looking at, I guess, the smoking wreckage and saying, well, what can we see in here, and what is it telling us about these systems? And okay, so to some extent, you know, this is where the theory end of this kind of gets bogged down, because I don't know what this means yet. And I said in the abstract that this is a work in progress. And you know, this is the thing that I am currently staring at and trying to make sense of. I mean, you can speculate. I mean, the fact you're getting corners turning up here is very interesting, because there's this little thread in the conformal field theory literature called corner entanglement. How am I doing for time? I'm happily yakking here. All right, I'm already 10 minutes late.
You started a bit late.
But I should wrap it up. Well, I mean, I'm not going to say too much more about this, because it just gets all vague and hand wavy, and I can point to a whole bunch of questions and no answers, and that's just going to sort of. So instead, I'm going to talk a little bit about real systems. Where did I put the zapper? Right, okay, there. Yeah, anyway, you have these. Now, I don't know that this is what you get. Right, I don't know what the excitations on this thing is. Right, so large government health warning. Just because it has excitations doesn't mean they're anions. They could be boring old electrons. Right, and until we know more about it, we should not get too excited about maybe these things are doing something interesting. But you can, if they do have non-trivial braiding statistics, the kind of braiding matrices that you're going to get could look like that, because we have these angle defects turning up, which are multiples. You can't even see that one. Angle defects turning up, which are going to be multiples of pi by 5. Right? Now, these I cut and pasted these from papers on Fibonacci quantum computation. So if you start seeing things turning up like that in braid matrices, that suggests that you have Fibonacci anions present. Okay, it's not a proof. There's huge gaps in this. But the fact that these things are naturally spitting out angle defects and angle excesses that are multiples of pi by 5 suggests that something like that might be going on here. Right, I mean, with hindsight, you know, Fibonacci anions are all about this factor of 5. It's kind of their calling card. And nobody's found them in the lab yet. But the systems we've been looking at have all been periodic lattices. And there's this famous result in group theory that says you can't have fivefold symmetry in periodic lattices. It's illegal. Right, if you want something with fivefold symmetries, basically quasicrystals are the only game in town. So maybe that's where these things are hiding. I mean, I have not, these are, I think, what were they? Plain vanilla Fibonacci's, right? They weren't something like Riazzi, which is more complicated and has extra phase factors in. So this is the simplest version. So there's no reason to think you're necessarily going to see something that looks exactly like that. But when you look at the braid matrices, you're going to, that's what you're looking for, that. And we now want to.
Can I just ask? So, I mean, is pi and phi in from the tiling is a geometric feature, right? I mean, why would we expect it to show up in the topological? I mean, would you, if you, you expect some kind of topological features in your code space or in your spectrum, then it should be insensitive to like deforming all of the points around them, which would change the angles. Why would I expect them to show up in like braid matrices though?
Okay. Well, first of all, one of the effects of the Penrose tiling is I'm not free to change the aspect ratio on this thing. It's locked in. Right? So arguments that talk about thin torus limits, you can't use those either. This thing is locked in to have these all be the same length. Right? And if you bend these angles at all, it's no longer a quasi-periodic tiling, right? It's a periodic approximant. So, you know, you are restricted as to what, how you can. No, so some of the limits that you would normally take for thin torus limit, right, you can't do that with these things. That limit is just not valid. I mean, you are also familiar with, I mean, stuff, you see some of this in the graphene literature. You have two sublattices, right? You can treat the degree of freedom of which sublattice as a pseudo-spin and call that a qubit. Right, now normally in, say, perfect graphene, you are running around on one of the sublattices. You don't talk to the other one. Right, so you know nothing interesting is happening. If you introduce a topological defect with non-trivial topology, specifically one that mixes the two sublattices, right, then you can get a topological effect from a geometric feature. Right, so the next question is, well, okay, what's the monodromy of that feature? So you know, if I start going around this, how many times do I have to go around it in order to get back to where I started? Right, because once you allow for being on different sublattices and phases not adding up and you get some anionic phase or what have you turning up. And it turns out you have to go around, actually works out to be you have to go around 10 times one of these to get back to where you started. Okay, so that is the basis on which I'm saying that you may be seeing this happening. Right, it's a consequence of, yes, it is originally a geometric feature. Once you factor in the fact that you had two separated sublattices before you started, but now you don't because you munged together the sublattices when you introduced the defect. I mean, this is a standard trick. I mean, that's why people like Mycem Barkeshli go and classify all possible defects, topological defects in graphene, is because some of them are kind of boring, like stone whales defects, for example. They don't do anything terribly interesting topologically. They're the most common type. But you can have other ones which are not. Right, and are topologically non-trivial, and you can do gates with them. So, you know, the idea that I can start with a topological defect, and funnily enough, quasicrystals often have topological defects, and I've not even looked at defects that just happen in the lattice naturally. You know, you've got something that goes in for defects, you may find that those defects actually, too many of them are obviously going to be a problem because you can't, it wrecks your transport properties. But you have something that's almost perfect with a small number of such defects which have, you know, that are conical defects, they come with an angle defect or an angle excess, right? That can actually be useful. I mean, does that answer your question? Sort of?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay, maybe is good. I mean, I'm only saying maybe, right? I'm not saying these things definitely have Fibonacci anions, but I mean, Fibonacci anions are quite tightly constrained because you have the pentagon rule and the hexagon rule, right? So once you have some of the ingredients, the other constraints kind of force things a bit. So the other one that I just flashed briefly is that these things actually occur naturally, right? I mean, there's quite a bit in topological quantum computing of we write down all these models and they're very cute, but unfortunately they don't occur in nature. This one was actually found in a meteorite. And funnily enough, this is actually one of the metastable quasicrystals. It's only actually stable at several hundred Kelvin. But, you know, because it's metastable, right, once it's in that state, if you cool it the right way, then it can stay there. I mean, the example of metastable versus true ground state, that's a good one to bear in mind, is graphene and diamond. Because at room temperature and pressure, graphene is actually the preferred state. Diamond is, strictly speaking, metastable. The energy gap is small, but it's there, and it favors graphene. But getting from one lattice structure to the other has a huge energy barrier, so it tends not to happen. And funnily enough, I mean, diamonds are famous for being hard, despite being the metastable solution. And graphene, well, graphite is kind of the poster child for being soft. That's why it's called graphite. You can write with it. So just because it's a metastable state doesn't mean that it isn't going to persist for a long period of time, and it doesn't mean that it's going to be soft and delicate. This thing survived, they reckon it was formed in the late heavy bombardment about 4 billion years ago as a result of an extremely violent collision between bodies in the asteroid belt. And it then sat there, sitting in the ambient radiation for like 4 billion years until it decided it was going to crash into Siberia. And it was left there lying in the mud for a few thousand years until somebody found it. Okay, and that's a remarkably clean lattice. And in fact, when the Steinhardt and Bindi and people who analyzed this, they said, actually, you know, this thing is comparable in quality to a really good lab specimen, which suggests that actually it's been annealed for a long time. So that Faison strain that I mentioned briefly has had time to work its way out. And you've got a nice clean lattice, so it's annealed, which is kind of what you'd expect. You've got a hot object in space. As a result of a collision, it's going to take a while to cool because vacuum is a very good thermal insulator, right? You know, this is how travel mugs work. So it could have taken a long time to cool and then get a nice tidy lattice, and then you can cool it all the way down to Siberia temperatures and below, and it doesn't break apart. So I went looking actually in the literature for information on low temperature behavior, specifically transport properties of quasicrystals, and there's actually not very much of it. I think the lowest temperature I found was one thing at 60 millikelvin, and that was an outlier. Most of them quite often are looking at temperatures in which these things are stable, which are like a few hundred Kelvin, so way hotter than this room, right? Never mind liquid helium temperatures. So there's kind of a great unknown in the literature there. The results are kind of ambiguous because the theory says that Faisons should propagate fairly rapidly. A Faison is like a higher dimensional version of a phonon. Right, you get lattice phonons in everything. If it's vibrating or doing the equivalent of vibrating in one of the dimensions that we projected out, right, that corresponds to a lattice rearrangement. If you move the acceptance window, right, you're going to get different things in the tiling. Right, it changes in a predictable way. That's a Faison strain, and the quasiparticles associated with that are called Faisons. Now, theory predicts that these things should propagate quite rapidly. Experiment says not so much. It's unclear whether this is because the theory is wrong or because the samples used in the experiments had lots of defects in them and they messed up the transport properties. So that's a complete unknown. It will be really, really interesting to find out. I think it's interesting to find out, and I hope I've persuaded you, or at least some of you, that this will be interesting to find out. Because these are, you know, these things are bosons. They're low energy bosons. They can be Goldstone modes. And I barely touched on the whole issue about thermal stability in toric codes, but there are some results that say you actually get a better threshold for thermal stability if you have a convenient boson bath. And I'm wondering if those can do that. But right now, I mean, it's a big unknown. Lots of, I mean, like I said in the abstract, a huge number of loose ends and unanswered questions. That I think would be interesting, and I hope, you know, some people in this room think are interesting. Hopefully all of you, but that's probably a bit much. At least one person, hopefully, thinks this is interesting. And I think this could be a new line of attack on this problem, because some people seem to be getting a little bit disillusioned about topological quantum computing because of all those awkward no-go theorems. And I think it's not dead yet. I think that, you know, there are ways around it, and there, you know, there's an awful lot of things which just go right if you switch to using a Penrose tiling. All sorts of things that were previously, you know, a major roadblock, just stop applying. And I'm going to stop waffling about this stuff because there's huge amount of stuff that I have left out, and I knew I was going to run out of time because there is always more stuff. and I'm just going to wrap this up now because I'm already overrunning by 20 minutes. Anyway, there's more where that came from, which if you look at it from the point of view of somebody who's trying to design a topological quantum computer, is really, really interesting. I mean, the fact that phasons, for example, behave like high-dimensional phonons. When I first ran this idea past an early version of this idea past Alyosha Hammer, he said, well, you can't do this because, A, if you just make the plaquettes, let's get this tiling back. The tiling that slid off, right? If you just make the plaquettes squares, right? And these things are stars, that doesn't work because it just gives you back the, it's another instance of the Kataya random plaquette model when that's boring, right? That's not qualitatively different from the two-dimensional toric code. It doesn't buy you anything doing that. And he also said, well, there's this paper that he'd written that shows about dimension scaling for heat propagation, the way that heat transport in toric codes, the way that scales with dimension. And he says, you know, there's no way that you can do that in 3D, because it needs to be in four dimensions, right? There it is, right? It's to do with, you know, it's a surface area to volume thing. And, you know, so I wasn't looking for that because I didn't think I'd find it. Right, I mean, come on. And yet, here you have these things that are nice low-temperature bosons that behave like higher-dimensional phonons. So I think I'm going to wrap up on that because, I mean, that was one of the what the heck moments with this. I think there's a number of things where you do this. You go looking in literature and you trip over stuff that you weren't even looking for because you didn't think it was realistic to look for it. And I think possibly the most shocking example is the behavior of phasons. I found an awful lot of papers by very confused chemists saying, we tried to model this in two dimensions, or three dimensions. We couldn't manage it. We can't make any sense of this unless we treat it in the original five or six dimensional space. And they're not happy about that. There's a lot of people, as you might imagine. But these systems seem to be determined to behave as if they lived in this high dimension. For reasons that I don't know why. If you tell me why do they do that, I can't tell you because I don't know what that Hamiltonian looks like. Right? I mean, this Hamilton thing that I blithely writ down here, I can tell you where the atoms are. I've got no idea how the interactions work between these. Right? They happen to form a hypercube, but I don't know. And yet, there are an awful lot of coincidences for this thing not to be doing something with topological properties that could be useful. So I think I am now definitely going to stop talking. Right, thank you for listening. So, any questions?
I think I heard you say at the beginning that you wanted to use something like a color, like the color code instead of the toric code.
Yeah, there's
that,
this.
That it wants to naturally live on hexagonal lattices.
Yeah, the color code is defined by Hector Bombin and Martin Delgado. The surname is Martin Delgado. I forget what his first name is. I think it's Martin, actually. They're defined on hexagonal lattices just because just the way they work. I think they're derived from the Bacon code, which is also defined on hexagonal lattices. And I can't remember how they work off the top of my head. But, I mean, well, Courtney's the real expert. He's written whole papers generalizing them. But they do have the feature that you can define them in terms of a pair of multiple toric codes and you fold them up. And I don't understand how that works. I'm still trying to read that paper. So I'm probably not a good person to ask about the finer points of color codes. But I can't rule it out. I do know that you write them down, you look at them in the papers, they're on a hexagonal lattice.